and welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important and fastest-growing segment of society, to those of you who come to realize that the world's religious, political, economic, academic, media, and military institutions are corrupt and that they are counterproductive. They cannot be fixed. They're not worth our time other than to expose and condemn them for what they have become. Our phone number, if you would like to participate in this discussion anytime over the next 2 hours, toll free 877-376-45. I am Yada. Just days after the Obama administration went to great and tortured pains to explain that their negotiation partner and their enemy in Afghanistan, as well as in Pakistan, both sides, again, in both theaters, is not considered a terrorist group. Yep. The Abominator wants you to view the Taliban differently. They're not a terrorist group, according to the Abominator. Now, there's a problem for the Abominator in that he has prolonged the war in Afghanistan. And he is equating the war in Afghanistan seamlessly with his war against terror. Now, that's hard to do if the foe that you're fighting in Afghanistan isn't a terrorist group now, isn't it? Well, the fact is that the Taliban is much more than an expression of Islamic terrorism. That their core, they're a religious organization. That is what their primary mission is to express and to demand absolute adherence to the Quran, to Muhammad's words and deeds, and therefore to Sharia law. Now, since Muhammad was a terrorist, since Muhammad ordered Muslims to be terrorists, since the Islamic God Allah claims to be a terrorist, that would make the Taliban a terrorist organization, in addition to other charming attributes, including being sexist, being wholly opposed to free will, wholly opposed to progress, wholly opposed to women, wholly opposed to education, and the list goes on and on. They'd be opposed to free speech. They would be opposed just to freedom in general. They would be opposed to freedom of religion. There's lots of labels that you could place on the Taliban that would be accurate. But to suggest that they are not a terrorist organization is just mind-bendingly stupid. Not that we should be surprised that the Obama administration would deliberately lie. If their lips are moving, they are lying. Almost everything they say is untrue, and it doesn't mean that they are somehow worse than a Republican option. They're not. When he ran against John McCain, that was the ultimate contest of the greater of two evils. And I'm not certain who would have been worse in the Romney election. But this I know. You can't claim to be engaged in the war on terror and call your remaining foe, the only one that you have troops actively engaged fighting, other than a terrorist organization. That's really tortured. Now, the reason they're doing it, of course, is that it's obvious. It was obvious 14 years ago. 14 years ago, I told everyone who would listen that we were going to experience another Vietnam in Afghanistan, that it would be impossible to distinguish between the civilians we were claiming to liberate and the fighters that we would be combating, that we would not be well received just as we were not well received in Vietnam, that no matter what puppet government we installed, once we took down the government we did not like, that it would be corrupt. That we would turn a bad situation in Afghanistan into a far worse situation. That Americans would die. Blood would be spilled. Afghanis would die. Their blood would be spilled. And we would squander not only our resources financially, but also our reputation by engaging in a prolonged battle that could not be won. It was a lose-lose scenario. And I use that term over and over again, comparing Afghanistan to Vietnam. Now, the only things that did not turn out to be identical, one is historical. We did not create the mess in Vietnam. The French did. We simply made it worse. In Afghanistan, we actually created the mess. America is wholly responsible for the Taliban being in charge of Afghanistan. We put them in power. We aided them. We armed them. That was during the Carter administration when Zbigniew Brzezinski was National Security Advisor. So in the case of Afghanistan, we actually made the mess that we went in and made worse. The second difference is only superficial. It's only true if you don't scratch beneath the surface, if you don't do a little research and think. And that is, in Vietnam, we lost almost 60,000 U.S. soldiers. And in Afghanistan, the number is in the range of 3,000. So you might say, well, that's not even remotely similar. It's a 20 times difference, even though the wars are of similar length, even though the exit strategy is identical. Negotiating with the very foe you went in to fight and re-identifying them only to see them return to power and nothing being different by the sacrifice of so much blood and coin, as was the case in Vietnam. But that's a superficial number. And the reason I say that is because if you track the fate of returning combat veterans, if you track the emergence of and the claims of post-traumatic stress syndrome, you know, between Afghanistan and Iraq, we had about 650,000 U.S. servicemen that played soldier. America now has 650,000 U.S. servicemen that have claimed post-traumatic stress syndrome, say that they're mentally incompetent and that they are receiving $6,000 a month from the U.S. government because they're plagued by the horrors of what they experienced. Now, mind you, this is not the kind of stress that comes from, gee, I wonder who's trying to kill me. It's the kind of stress is, oh my God, I've been lied to by my government. I'm in a command and control institution, the U.S. military, where I have no freedom of any kind, where I can't leave. I have been universally lied to. This is not as it was purported to be. It's impossible to determine friend and foe. Those that I'm supposed to be here to help would just as soon kill me. And when you're engaged doing things this depraved. And many servicemen, when they went over there, there was a game, and you had to get your first kill. It didn't matter who you killed. You kill a little boy, kill a little girl, kill a woman going to the market. Doesn't matter, just need to get your first kill. They're really screwed up. But beyond that, the numbers are that 22 returning vets are taking their lives in suicide every single day. Now, that 22, though, is just from 40% of the states are states representing 40% of the U.S. population. And even in those states from which 22 returning vets are taking their lives, suicide every day, killing themselves because of what they experienced, there's only 70% reporting in those states. So it doesn't take much to do the math. The number is between 75 and 80 returning combat vets that are taking their lives via suicide every day. And when you look at the numbers over the time that we've been engaged in Vietnam and men and women have come home, what you find is the death toll in Afghanistan is much greater than it was in Vietnam. And now we're going through the label game. We're going to call them by a different name. Hello, Glenn. So you found our new time slot.
It's good. Oh, yes. I've been aware of it. It's not as generally accessible. So
I know. I'm kidding you, and I'm sure that that what was convenient for me is not as convenient for you, and I apologize for that.
No, that's fine. Plus, it's been snowy and busy and sick kids. No, like
I'm yanking your chain. I'm yanking your chain, Glenn. I'm not really complaining.
Yeah, I gotcha. Gotcha. So, well, you know, the French and their vaunted Foreign Legion troops got their posteriors waxed at Dien Bien Phu, and we were going to go in and show them how it's done. And,
We American bravado.
From that experience. Yeah, we didn't learn from that experience.
No, we didn't, did we? You know, we tried that same game in Korea, didn't we? You know, what's so interesting about Korea is that in Korea, we actually made the mess that we tried to fix in Korea because they, between FDR and Marshall, his Secretary of War, and Eisenhower and Dulles, the Secretary of State, they pulled the wool, they pulled really all of the resources away from and support away from Chiang Kai-shek in China and gave it to Mao Zedong because Mao Zedong was a more vicious fighter. And, you know, America always likes to think that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, the Sun Tzu concept.
Chiang Kai-shek, and they lost to Formosa, they went.
Yeah, and then what happened is that the Mao Zedong group, because of American support, ended up taking over the country. Not only did 40 million Chinese die as a result of America's stupidity and immorality in this regard, but...
Hello?
The Korean battle that we lost another, 30,000-40,000 Americans trying to stop that avalanche and failed. You know, it was we went from where we thought we had won a war to losing one, and then we played the same game. Let's stop the communists in the north in Vietnam, and then when we failed miserably, making a bad situation worse, sacrificing so many American lives. And went off and played the same game again in Afghanistan and then in Iraq. And now we're trying to do it in Syria. Do you think we'll ever learn, Glenn?
No. No, we're not learning.
No. Stay with us. We'll return. Yeah, we'll return after the commercial break. So we have the Obama administration now with tortured explanations to say that the Taliban is no longer considered a terrorist group. And yet, you know that the day after he made that announcement, Glenn, that the Taliban successfully infiltrated an American facility there, and they murdered three American contractors. Now, when you're armed, and you're a religious or political movement, and you're trying to elicit change, and you attack and deliberately murder for the purpose of eliciting, promoting your cause, unarmed civilians. Is there a textbook definition for such behavior?
I think it would be called terrorism, but they might try and get away with calling it insurgents, calling them insurgents, but they're not insurgents because they're the indigenous populace.
Yep.
And the thing is, there we go. I think the word Taliban means student. So these people are students. They read the Quran and the Hadith, and they're trying to follow them. And the reason they're hemmed in on this language is because if the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan tomorrow, the Taliban would be right back in control of everything associated with the government.
Yeah.
And so
what happened in Vietnam when we left, Glenn?
Well, the helicopters flew away from the embassy, and the victorious, you know, northern Vietnamese took control of things, and with a lot of influence from communist China.
Yep.
And the country today is
a small point, but you mean the point is that yes, the moment we left Vietnam, the foe that we were fighting prevailed, and the puppet government that was so corrupt that we installed collapsed, and it was as if we had never been there except for all of the bloodshed and coin spilt. The one slight difference.
Much more greatly cemented.
One slight difference. The provocateur, the American provocateur in Vietnam, wasn't China. I'm sure that China was having a good old time watching us.
Russians were involved, sir.
Yes, the Russians. Yeah, it was the Russians. And that's the reason for Afghanistan is because the Russians were involved. Now, the Russians were involved as the Soviet Union because it was during the Cold War, and no matter what the conflict was around the world, the United States and Russia were on one side or the other, the old Soviet Union, supplying weapons. You know, it's kind of like what America does today, except we don't have a counterpart supplying weapons on the other side. Now we just supply both sides with weapons. But during the good old days of the Cold War, the Soviet Union supplied weapons on one side, we supply weapons on the other. And so Americans were being killed with Soviet-made weapons. But it was really interesting, too, for those who love conspiracy, the fact of the matter is that most of the Russian weapons were of American design, and they were built in factories that were constructed by and managed by Americans in the Soviet Union.
Right.
We killed them. We killed our own.
That's just amazing duplicity. Yeah, I remember people talking about the Ford trucks that the Vietnamese and stuff were using.
You know, it's interesting. If you go back about a year ago, the Abominator was actually negotiating with the Taliban and in Qatar, and they were talking about negotiating the transition of Americans out of Afghanistan and the turnover of that country back to the Taliban. It was exactly like we did with Henry Kissinger in the Peace with Honor negotiations in Paris.
Right. Well, actually, if you compare and contrast the outcome in Korea with Vietnam, actually, even though Vietnam was more conclusively, you know, a loss, and yet today Americans can travel in Vietnam without fear of being assassinated or things like that. You know, it has a functioning economy. If you look at the situation,
the domino theory that we went into Vietnam to stop, that was, you know, because we have to always justify the fact that American soldiers are protecting American freedom and serving Americans, not going off there and dying for some stupid political agenda in some foreign country for no apparent reason. So in Vietnam, the apparent reason was the domino theory. If we allow communism to take over this country, they'll take over the next country. And certainly, and soon there'll be, that domino will fall and America will become communist. Well, you know, Vietnam became communist, and it wasn't such a bad thing for them, was it? In fact, it was better than the government we installed.
Yeah, their economy's functioning pretty well. The people are still coming across American mines and that sort of thing. But look at Korea.
Yes.
With the armistice and the DMZ, it's a disaster. It's a nightmare.
Right. Still is. And what do we have up north in that cordoned-off realm? We have a regime that is incredibly savage on its own people. People starving to death. Total and complete hell. In North End, a belligerent that now is nuclear armed. It didn't work out for us well in Korea. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. You know, Glenn, there is one other aspect of Vietnam that people would view differently than Afghanistan. Now, of course, you know, there's the superficial. One was being fought in a desert, and the other being fought in a jungle. Okay, big
Buddhist,
whoop.
But not Islamic.
Now, the fact is that the principal foe in Vietnam was the religion of man, socialism, the communism, and it is as and was is remains has been a as powerful a force as there has been on earth in terms of a dogma that will cause people to sacrifice their lives and die for the cause. It has been on par, in fact, even more influential than any standard religion, far more influential than Christianity or Islam in terms of motivating people to fight and kill others. It has been far more invasive, socialism, communism, humanism, has been far more invasive in the media in the West and in educational systems and reshaping people's morals than any religion ever has been. And so that was the foe. And what we're this inability to see dogmas as all man-made constructs, and whether the dogma is humanism and communism, or the dogma is Islam or Christianity, we somehow put them at far extremes, just as we have this tendency to put communism and fascism at far extremes when they're really only tiny shades of gray to separate them.
Totalitarian. Yeah, they're all violent, totalitarian, and oligarchical.
Yes. The religions and the political schemes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all of them. And so our inability to make that connection, we were fighting against a dogma that we did not understand and that motivated its adherents to be willing to sacrifice their lives in numbers and in ferocity that we could not understand, just as we are witnessing in Afghanistan, and we witnessed in Iraq, and we're witnessing in Syria, and we don't seem to learn from that, that when you have a dogma that is motivating such passion, such willingness to be enraged and to die for the cause, you've really got to deal with the underlying motivation, and the only way you can deal with that is words, evidence, and reason. You
right.
cannot prevail in that kind of a conflict with bullets and bombs. And, you know, in Vietnam, with every bomb we dropped, particularly the herbicides and napalm, we manufactured a lot more enemy than we killed. And the same thing is true in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it's because we don't fight wars using words, using evidence and reason.
Well, it's amazing that the Vietnamese are not more bitter towards us than they are. They're still, their farmers are still stumbling across mines and bomblets that, you know, have been there since the war. But occasionally a child would get blown up from that sort of thing. But, again, just looking back on the potential for recovery, post-war recovery in these nations, it's fascinating because the Vietnamese, okay, the U.S. pulls out, Russian and communist influences are in there. You've got Vietnam influenced by Russia, China, the U.S. Mm-hmm. culture to some degree, and the French culture to some degree.
Right.
And that, I think some of those underpinnings, plus centuries of Buddhism, those people were not inherently communist. That was a relatively new imposed ideology, which was like a veneer.
But think for a moment about Buddhism and communism. And think of the similarities between the two and just humanism in general. Buddhism is a humanist religion. It's the crossover religion. It's the religion that unites. It's the connection, if you will, between the godless religions of socialism, communism, humanism, secularism, and the false god religions of Christianity and Islam and Hinduism. The one in between is Buddhism, because in Buddhism there is no God, and it's all about.
I would say Buddhism seeks the great nothingness, and Hinduism seeks the great everythingness. That's why it has such an innumerable pantheon. Hinduism's very polytheistic and
but Buddhism is a code of life that becomes a collective that governs people's interactions with others and controls the individual. And it really is very similar to humanism and to communism and socialism. I think it's one of the reasons why in the West, the more liberal a person is, typically, the more comfortable they are adding the concept of Buddhism and Buddhist edicts to their lives.
Oh, and all Eastern religion, the yoga, meditation, all
mm-hmm.
that stuff.
Sure.
Or even Eastern religion, feng shui, when it's from Chinese and stuff mm-hmm. like that. You know, like all this stuff, nature.
Yeah.
But
the meditation replaces faith.
Right. But at least the Buddhism is less inherently misanthropic and oppressive than the communism. If you look at Korea, South Korea became like a wholly owned subsidiary of Mitsubishi. The Japanese came in there economically. That's why we're buying Kias today and Mitsubishis and stuff. And
typically, you know, Buddhists are more typically passive. They withdraw into themselves and are passive, where when Christianity was empowered, it was aggressive. Islam is aggressive. Communists have been the most aggressive and deadly in the last 150 years. So, you know, that is a distinguishing aspect of them. But still, it is right in between religion and these humanist kinds of dogmas.
Right. Well, North Korea is the perfect example of the worst of humanism, the worst of communism, the worst of totalitarianism. It's dysfunctional from top to bottom, economically, you name it. It's oppressive. But the interesting thing is, even in any of these countries, we're not looking at Islam as a factor. In terms of potential for recovery, I mean, in the Islamic nations, they tend to be sort of... they don't implement technologies very readily. In the Emirates, they use technologies for war, but basically, they keep the people in a very undeveloped state.
You know, Muhammad in the Quran says that Islam cannot change, that if anyone tries to alter anything that he said or did and his influence, Muhammad's influence on an individual's life, that individual has to be done away with. They have to be killed. And so Islam, by the very nature of the Quran and its statements and the nature of Muhammad and his statements, it can't evolve. It is exactly as it always was.
They're afraid of the Saudis and the Emirates and the Qataris and are afraid of them because they've embraced technology. They like their malls. They like their fancy cars.
Actually, Islam was a step backwards because what Muhammad did is he imposed the religious edicts of his ancestors, the pagan religious idol worship of his ancestors. He imposed that on Arabs, and then he added a bit of communal killing, and the booty sharing mechanism was a bit socialistic. So he kind of blended the two together to create a very formidable terrorist machine.
Right. And they're very, they always talk about, you hear people say, look at the pejoratives they're using, camel jockeys or cavemen, stuff like that. But it's because of this Luddite, this very Luddite approach to anti-technology, anti-development, anti-productivity and growth.
Anti-education, you can't be inventive. You can't explore the boundaries. You can't explore free speech. You can't explore freedom of religion. And in a culture where the scripture says that lying is considered good, stealing is considered good, killing is considered good, and sexual abuse is considered good, all of those things are praised in the Quran. How in the world are you going to have a productive economy, which is absolutely dependent on fairness, honesty?
Right, you're not.
You're not.
And a
fair political system, which is predicated on access to complete and open access to information via free speech. And free speech is not allowed in Islam. So there is nothing we can do that will reshape the Islamic world into our image. And, there was it was interesting. There's an article that I was going to get to today that is all about the judicial system of Afghanistan. And America spent billions of dollars building courthouses and training lawyers and judges to impose the Western series thought of jurisprudence. So that was America's great contribution. And we had these schools, we've built the buildings, we've created the people doing these various things, and we're paying for them. Now, while we've done that, of course, the treatment of women has worsened appreciably in Afghanistan, so it hasn't worked. But what we read now is that Afghanistan has wholly and completely disregarded that system. And now when there is a dispute, it's always taken to a Taliban elder, and the Taliban elder is ruling based upon the Quran and Sharia law.
And the Sharia, I mean, actually, the Sharia law aspect of thing is the real deal breaker. I mean, and it troubles me when I see things like, I hear people advocating on behalf of Islam or the Palestinians and that sort of thing, and then they'll turn around and deny its effects on things like Birmingham, England being a no-go zone, or Dearborn, Michigan being pushed more and more towards Sharia law. It's like, how, you know, because you're not right there, how bad do things have to get before you rebel against this?
Yeah. You know, first of all, I think calling Birmingham a no-go zone was a mistake. Birmingham does have a higher percentage of Muslims than do some communities, although there are communities within London proper that have a very high percentage of Muslims. But as for a no-go zone, I think that was hyperbole. But the fact of the matter is that Islam does destroy everything it touches. We'll be back. Yes, indeed. Fun with labels. The Obama administration wants you to believe now that the Taliban, whom we have engaged for the past 14 years in the war against terrorism, is not a terrorist organization. So what were we doing in Afghanistan? Glenn, if the Taliban is not a terrorist organization, who have we been fighting the war against terror against?
We've been fighting the people we armed when the Soviets were in there.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, the Taliban. And of course we went in to get Al-Qaeda when Al-Qaeda didn't conceive the plan for 9/11, and it didn't take anything to rid Afghanistan of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was so small, so irrelevant in this whole thing, never been meaningful, and we continue to pretend like we're fighting a battle against Al-Qaeda long after Al-Qaeda has ceased to even be, well, as relevant as Naval Lint.
Well,
imagine that, you know, trillions of dollars to fight a few hundred individuals.
Well, these uppity vassals and their tributaries, you know, start getting independent ideas. It doesn't matter whether you're Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi or the Taliban. You know, once we start giving you weapons, you got to do what we say. And if you don't, well, then we'll just have to, you know.
Right. Then we'll use our weapons to fight you using our weapons.
Right. And if you try to undermine Bretton Woods, especially more than anything, you know, and the dollar, well, then that's heresy, you know. So, if you're trying to be, if you're Muammar Gaddafi and you're trying to float your own gold dinar, well, that's just totally out of the question.
Yeah. You know, if you look at the only difference between now and the Cold War, in the Cold War, you had the Soviet Union arming one side and the U.S. arming the other side, and then we had various puppets fight and kill lots of people using either our weapons or the Soviet weapons, and we justified all of that in that this global war against communism, and then we both lose. In fact, they actually won. They lost the control mechanism of communism. They were liberated, and we were became servitude, servants to our debt, and embraced socialism here in America. It was a war that we actually lost. But now that America is the lone belligerent, I mean, we are universally supplying the weapons on both sides. You can't have a more worse situation than Iraq and Syria, where all of the weapons on both sides are American.
Right. Well, what have we to fear as long as the big news Brzezinski says God's on their side?
Yeah, it's one of the most chilling, discouraging, immoral videos I've ever witnessed. And I don't know how many of our listeners have actually listened to it, but you should Google Zbigniew Brzezinski speaking to the Taliban, telling them that that God is on their side. And, you know, he's on some unforsaken hill, probably in Pakistan, overlooking Afghanistan. And he's surrounded by the Taliban, which he's renting from the Pakistani government. And he's telling them that with the help of American weapons, that Allah will guide them, that Allah will cause them to be victorious against those infidels down there in Afghanistan. There he is, speaking on behalf of the Islamic God, all because he despises socialism. He's going to align with Islam and created the very mess that we witnessed
today. And then he had to fly back so he could become a mentor for Barack Obama.
Yeah, Zbigniew Brzezinski has had a significant influence over Barack Obama. They share much of the same ideology, although Barack Obama is, where I think Zbigniew Brzezinski had to lie through his teeth to feign his allegiance to Allah and Islam to hoodwink the Taliban into being our proxy against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. I think with Barack Obama, it not only comes naturally. I think that his loyalty is far and away with Muslims over anyone else on Earth, and his behavior and even his dictates indicate that.
That happens when you attend a madrasa in your youth.
It does. Yeah, when you come from an Islamic upbringing, it happens that way.